طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is so important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. We begin this week with a recording of Representative Rashida Tlaib of Michigan, the newly elected and only Palestinian member of the House of Representatives, speaking to a delegation who had come to Washington on a lobbying mission. One of the members of the delegation sent a recording of the session, and I thought it really reflected her approach to her job as a congresswoman. So here is Representative Tlaib speaking to the delegation who had come to visit her in her office in Washington, D.C.
I can tell you, I always tell people they didn't just let any Arabiya in Congress, they let a Falaha in Congress. I'm very, very proud of this incredible opportunity. But I got to tell you, I think when I go to Palestine, I'm Americania, but when I'm in Congress, I'm so much more Palestinian than I am anywhere else in the world. but I'm really proud to be able to somehow uplift the incredible hardship and pain of being oppressed as Palestinians are every single day and feeling less than. When I ran for Congress and even before that, I was always speaking truth to power. I always was very much at the center of any kind of movement where oppression or, again, this, I always call myself a humanist. This anything that impacted people and feeling less equal and less humane in many ways of some of the actions. When I won my Sitti Muftiya in Beit Ur al-Fuqa, not Tehta, in Beit Ur, she goes, Khalas, halat Palestine. I said, Sitti. I was like, that's not how it works. I was like, Palestine's not free until we do this movement. And there's an incredible woman by the name of Grace Lee Boggs in the city of Detroit who always said, different movements, if it's not the women's rights movement, it's not the civil rights movement, it's not even just pushing back against anti-blackness in our country that continues to be prevalent, it is always from movements outside the halls of Congress, outside of the White House. It isn't inside. It is with all of you. So yes, I'm there. I'm one of, I call it like now an activist is now in Congress. But many of you are the reason that somebody like me could even be possible, that I have the courage to constantly speak truth about what is happening in Palestine every single day. I being the eldest of 14, mashallah, I've been taking care of people all my life. Yeah, I don't know how many of you know that. Yeah. Palestinians are not going anywhere. We really do produce. Not one or five, right? Like five, like we're not, we produce. they can't erase us. And so I can tell you, getting people through everyday issues is what I've been doing for my family since being in the Michigan legislature and now in Congress. I have families that have been born in this country and still feel the sense of inequality. Because of their income class, because of their faith, or because of anything that they're going through, their immigration status, whatever it is. And so much of me growing up in that community in Detroit, and then you stick a little bit of Palestinian in you, in my blood, I'm a warrior. And no one will tell me not to shush me or be quiet. Every time they do, I kind of escalate it. But it's because of the fact that I was raised in a predominantly black community, where every corner is a reminder of the civil rights movement. And I say this to all of you because today so many of you came to visit me and you said, well, what can we do? And I said to every single one, Like, what is AMP doing about what's happening at the border? You know, like, really, because to me, that's another form of what's happening in Gaza, where people are literally getting children ripped apart from them, but dealing with the fact that they're being caged and all of the heart, everything, the tragedy, the fact that when they cry for their parents, they're being injected with medicine, like literally drugs, to make them stop crying for their parents. That's what our country is doing right here. And I say this to all of you, is like, I think of Palestine when I see that. I get so emotional because I think to myself, why is this happening right on our watch? So you all need to understand the way we succeed is when we speak up for others. When we speak up for others. So when it's police brutality, when it's anti-immigrant movement, when it's anything, even homophobia, all of it, you have to understand. We have to speak up. And we do it and by bringing Palestine at the forefront. When I say to people, do you know what it feels like to go to Palestine with my mother who has to get in a separate line with a different color passport that literally is going through checkpoints? Do you know what it feels like? Well, my African-American teachers knew what that felt like to be in a segregated community. That's how you connect this movement to what's happening. And that's what we need to be doing every single day. A lot of you younger people know that. You're on campuses organizing around, I mean, even the economic boycott movement. My God, if we didn't have the Montgomery bus boycotts, where could we have been without that? And it's nobody, no one should say to us that that isn't protected for First Amendment right. It absolutely is. You know, my family is super excited about my delegation to Palestine. And I can tell you, for all of those, as you're visiting members of Congress, when they want to hear and be balanced, tell them, go on the trip. Go hear another side of the story that you never have heard of, because this is an opportunity. Never in history of the United States Congress is there now a member with a living grandmother in the West Bank, in the occupied territories of Palestine. This is an opportunity to open up your eyes to see why there's still a cry after over 50 years of occupation, cry for Palestinian human rights, for equality, for justice. This is their opportunity to hear a side that they may not have been exposed to ever in history of their service to their districts. And so it is important that all of you, as you're sharing your stories, as you're talking to members of Congress, please, you know, share those stories, but also ask them to open their eyes to the other side. And I say that because I hear so many people wanting to choose sides. And I say, well, why don't you start with your values? Because if you start with your values at the end, you would all agree that Palestinians deserve equality and deserve human rights and don't deserve to feel less than in their country that they were born in for 3 or 4 or 5, 6, sometimes 100 generations. So I'm really pleased that you're all here. I got to tell you, next time you got to check with me on the schedule, folks. Like, members of Congress don't get in really until tonight. So you should have stayed for one more day. That's why it seems so empty and like it looks like we're not doing. It's because tonight is our first vote is tonight. And so we're here until Tuesday and then Wednesday, usually we until Thursday. But Tuesday, Wednesday is always your best bet if you fly in. That way you can actually talk to the members of Congress, not just staff people. So just remember that. It's very important because I want you guys to be seen. You know, I always tell people this is an institution that may not have been ready for someone like me, and really, on all different ways. But I want you all to be heard and be seen, and so it's important. And for all the young people that came, one of them told me that the member didn't want to meet with them or the staff didn't want to meet with them. I said, well, next time go outside of the room and in front of their plaque and say, we're here being American, civically engaged people, and they don't want to meet with us, and tweet it. Tweet it out. Like, you know, like, expose them. You know, I think if you're in front of a member of Congress's office and their staff and nobody really wants to pay attention to you, in appointment or no appointment, at least having some sort of engagement, if you're feeling like you're not being heard or seen, then, you know, share that publicly because it actually makes them better public servants when you do that. It makes them hear you much better. I know many of you heard this joke, but you know, my mother really, really, truly believes, like, it's so funny. She's like, all the time, she goes, Shufti, Shufti. I'm like, Amin Shuftim, Shufit Minya, Mom. And she goes, have you seen him? Have you seen him? And I was like, Mama, because the Trump, because that's how they say it. And I was like, she's like, are you talking about Trump, Mom? And she's like, yeah, yeah, Mama, Shufti. I said, no, Mama, he doesn't walk in the halls of Congress. He's not like walking around. And my mom is so sad because it's funny and sad at the same time. She's actually afraid of her own president, She's afraid of him. And that is scary that you're afraid for the first time ever, you know, like ever. Afraid. I mean, yeah, you're afraid of her, but afraid of the leader of our country, and afraid of her daughter being somehow connect. You know, him seeing me and things. I said, Mama, he can't do nothing to me. I'm in Congress, and so yeah. But I can't. Yeah. And it's funny, and she really believes that the way to fix all of this, from all the hate, if you're Arab, you're not Muslim, whatever it is, all the different levels of hate, she really believes like Palestine would be, the issue around Palestine would be just completely fixed if people just knew that Jesus was born in Palestine. And honest to God, she tells everybody. The guy yelled at her to take off her hijab at a supermarket, and she's like, you don't understand. Jesus was born in my country. And so my mom really believes if we can just let people know that all of a sudden the lights will come in through the windows and things would shine and all of a sudden Palestine would be free again. But thank you all so much for your incredible advocacy, for your strength and your courage. Thank you.
That was Congressional Representative Rashida Tlaib of Michigan speaking to a delegation which was visiting her in her office in Washington, D.C. And now the feature presentation, which this morning is an address to a conference organized by the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs in Washington, D.C. by Brad Parker of Defense for Children International, an advocacy and legal group seeking to defend Palestinian children who continue to face high incarceration rates imposed by the Israeli military. We begin with an introduction by Dale Spruzansky.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for sticking with us through a long day. And we're going to get started here with another important topic of discussion, and that is legislative efforts to help Palestinians, especially innocent Palestinian children, which you think would not be a controversial task, but it is. In 2017, Representative Betty McCollum of Minnesota introduced the Promoting Human Rights by Ending Israeli Military Detention of Palestinian Children Act in the House of Representatives. This piece of legislation would have prevented U.S. funds from being used to support the detention, interrogation, or ill treatment of Palestinian children by the Israeli military, which of course receives at least $3.8 billion a year in U.S. aid. 30 members of Congress co-sponsored this bill. And there's no questioning the urgency of this legislation. According to Defense for Children International Palestine, Israel prosecutes roughly 700 Palestinian children a year in its military courts, and 75% of those children report experiencing some form of abuse. So here to elaborate on this is Brad Parker. He is Senior Advisor, Policy and Advocacy at Defense for Children International, one of the organizations that endorsed Representative McCollum's bill. He specializes in issues of juvenile justice and grave violations against children during armed conflict, and leads his organization's legal advocacy efforts for Palestinian children's rights. He will discuss lessons activists can take away from the Promoting Human Rights Act that McCollum introduced. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Dale. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm happy to see folks with smiles, and it feels that there is still some energy here. So I'll try to move quickly through the next 20 minutes or so and keep it snappy so we can get to some questions. So first, just to explain the organization that I work for, Defense for Children International Palestine is a local Palestinian child rights organization. It was founded in 1991 specifically to provide legal aid to Palestinian children charged in the Israeli military courts. So everything that I'll talk about around military detention comes from that experience of having lawyers defend Palestinian children in the military courts. We do court visits, represent kids. We do prison visits. We collect affidavits, questionnaires, information on the ill treatment that they face. So our entire sort of work is grounded in that legal aid experience. Over the past few decades, many people generally deemed engagement with lawmakers in the U.S. around Palestinian rights issues as futile. Even recently, many people have avoided it. Many people in this room probably avoid it. I won't ask for a show of hands, but I assume that if you have engaged with sort of direct outreach to your members of Congress, it's been a bit of a stressful experience at times. For the same reason, Defense for Children International Palestine and other local Palestinian human rights organizations also did not prioritize engagement with lawmakers in the U.S. We focused a lot of efforts in different European countries, through the EU, UN, human rights mechanisms, but never really brought something clear, direct, and proactive to American policymakers. There's been a lot of necessary effort that's been put into public education campaigns in the U.S., speaking tours, BDS efforts, which all have helped build and expand a broad U.S.-based movement demanding equality, freedom, and justice for Palestinians. In this context, DCI Palestine was sort of wondering what our role could be if we had a permanent presence in the U.S. So really starting as early as 2009, following Israeli military offensive on Gaza, December 2008 into January 2009, Operation Cast Lead, we saw openings in the U.S. Increasing use of social media allowed Palestinians to share their human experience of occupation, of military offensives. Students for Justice in Palestine organizing and developing networks among college campuses all started to create more space where a local Palestinian organization like DCI Palestine could come and have a contribution with our evidence base that we use. We looked at the landscape of what was happening in the U.S., and we wanted to try to figure out how we could have the most impact. We didn't want to be redundant. We wanted to complement the efforts that were happening. We have a focus and a mandate to specifically monitor rights violations against children, and we saw that as a really clear issue to bring to Americans, where congressional advocacy, working with policymakers, can be quite contentious. So our goal was to complement efforts that were already happening, and that's sort of where we arrived at a congressional advocacy campaign. We wanted to create something that would leverage the ongoing work towards political action and political change. So in 2014, a handful of individuals organized by the American Friends Service Committee and Defense for Children International Palestine came together in Chicago with the intention of building an evidence-based, rights-based congressional advocacy campaign. We wanted to demonstrate not only that it wasn't futile to engage with members of Congress on Palestinian rights, but that it was entirely necessary if we wanted to build the political power to force the change that was needed. So from these initial discussions, our No Way to Treat a Child campaign was born. We launched in 2015, and the goal was to engage members of Congress on a narrowly tailored and compelling child rights issue, like widespread and systematic ill treatment of Palestinian children arrested by Israeli forces and prosecuted in military courts. In the first 3 years, the campaign has mobilized an extensive network of people across the U.S. through this kind of strategic congressional advocacy. As Dale had mentioned, in November 2017, we celebrated a historic moment when Representative Betty McCollum introduced H.R. 4391. My task here is to share lessons that activists and others can take away from this legislation. So to do that, I want to sort of tell you how we did it. So the first kind of piece is our success is entirely built around evidence-based, rights-based advocacy. So what is that? Right? So when meeting with policy and decision makers around the world, including members of Congress and their staff, I utilize the human rights documentation that we collect from children and families and our lawyers, documentation that they bring. And that's the basis for our discussions. We use international humanitarian law, international human rights law, universal rights protections that apply to any person, right? Combined with the evidence that we bring. And that human rights law, that humanitarian law, is the guide, right? It's not about final status issues or a legacy of Oslo, right? It's not these sort of traditional policy decisions that go into discussions around Israel-Palestine. And we want that policymakers to put those issues to the side. Issues of borders, territory, Jerusalem, security, Israel as a Jewish state, all of these are essentially irrelevant to a rights-based approach. So what is a rights-based approach? Generally, it's an approach that utilizes international human rights law as a framework to advance and operationalize the promotion and protection of universal human rights for all persons. So-called final status issues are the context and reference point that many following the Israel-Palestine portfolio bring to the table. And yes, resolution of these issues would have ramifications for individual Palestinian rights. However, the real main point is that if you're trying to advance Palestinian human rights by highlighting the human impact of Israeli occupation, then the main point is that realization of human rights is not contingent on the resolution of these final status issues. So we use international law, we use the evidence that we collect to really proactively shape the conversation that we have with these policymakers in a way that doesn't necessarily contradict their policy positions. So pragmatically, a human rights-based approach provides a framework to concretely articulate the human rights denials and violations inherent in Israeli military occupation. It provides a framework to examine systemic inequality, discrimination, oppression, and other issues that are deeply rooted in Israeli military occupation of Palestinians. It allows us to use a framework to lay out rights and wrongs that relatedly lets us advocate and identify specific policies and pass forward. And really what we're trying to have come across through this evidence-based, rights-based advocacy is that at the heart of it, Palestinians are entitled to universal human rights regardless of whether a policy or decision maker sort of emphatically supports a two-state solution or not. Right, we want to remove that as an obstacle because in the end, right, it's about human rights, equality, justice, freedom, and human dignity. So that... So in that, our goal is to empower members of Congress to adopt this rights-based discourse so that they can acknowledge that Palestinians are, right, for example, entitled to basic and fundamental rights like equality, civil and political rights, freedom from torture, ill treatment. It's meant to free them up and empower them to speak out on things that are happening without being hemmed in by kind of the constraints of Washington when it comes to policy that's traditionally been the norm for Israel-Palestine. So connecting this rights-based discourse to specific human experience is kind of where we've been successful. So how many people, show of hands, know the name Tariq Abu Qader, a Palestinian-American teen beaten in Jerusalem? Video went viral in summer 2014, right? In one of our first congressional, when we launched the campaign in June 2015, Tariq and his mother were part of the congressional briefing that we organized in Washington. So connecting kind of the rights-based discourse, the evidence with the human experience is the thing that's been compelling in our work. Others sort of along the way, including Ahed Tamimi, kind of the most recent high-profile detention of a child, and then Fawzi Al-Junaidi, who is the boy in this photo that went viral, a DCI Palestine attorney, my colleague Farah Bayadzi, represented him in the military courts. Right, these are the stories that we try to bring to these policymakers. So, lesson one, integrate as best you can a rights-based discourse into your efforts and center that those efforts around these compelling human stories. Because in the end, I think connecting, whether it's child rights issues, other issues, if you can show the human impact of policies, of occupation, it's a much more visceral, dynamic, real message that you're bringing to these policymakers. So that's sort of the strategy and thinking behind the campaign and the way that we created it. To actually build the campaign, to use this congressional advocacy engagement to mobilize people, we had to create vehicles to do so. So we wanted to create vehicles that facilitated engagement, discussion with lawmakers, and allowed that relationship building that's so key to doing political work to create political change. From using congressional briefings, that allowed us to create a presence on Capitol Hill. We organized Dear Colleague letters, right? Members of Congress signing on to letters, statements, sending them to, in our case, the first Dear Colleague letter we did was sent to Secretary of State John Kerry at the time. We went in to that June 2015 launch in D.C., hoping to get one member of Congress to sign on to that letter. We ended up with 19, right? And that was sort of the starting point. We went from there. Right? That letter was initiated by Representative Betty McCollum. It highlighted the ill-treatment of Palestinian child prisoners in the Israeli military detention system, and essentially urged the State Department to elevate the human rights of Palestinian child detainees to a priority status within bilateral discussions between the State Department and Israeli authorities. At the time, it felt sort of groundbreaking. And I think it was. we shocked ourselves a bit, but it also sort of confirmed the things that we knew or thought to be true. If we could have narrow, sort of compelling issues, put them to policymakers, like we could have a positive response. So we took that letter, we sort of used it to mobilize people throughout the U.S. Through the end of 2015 into early 2016. We sort of used that letter just to show and say, you know, this isn't futile. We can do this. A lot of the people that in that first meeting in Chicago in 2014, you know, when I said we wanted to focus on Congress, there were some laughs. Some people got up and walked out. And after we had that first Dear Colleague letter, right, those people were back in the room and said, we had no idea that this could be possible right now. So that was the hope we were trying to create and build on and use to sort of further things. So 2016, we needed another vehicle. We did another Dear Colleague letter. That time it was sent to President Obama, also led again by Representative Betty McCollum, a letter called for the creation of a special envoy for Palestinian youth in the Department of State to follow, monitor, and report on what at the time was a deteriorating situation across the West Bank for not only Palestinian children, but Palestinians generally. That work essentially created the landscape where legislation became possible. Looking at the 2016 election, we knew we were going to have to probably change tactics, try to get a bit bolder, and then once the Trump administration came in, we sort of had to throw plans out and force ourselves to be even more creative. We knew we needed something longer term, right? These Dear Colleague letters, they sort of last for about 3 weeks, 4 weeks, maybe a couple months, and then you get the signers and they get sent. They're sort of quick reactions, or they can be sort of proactive statements on something, but we really needed that long-term organizing vehicle to push things forward. And that came in HR 4391. So we worked with Betty McCollum's staff to draft and eventually introduce the bill, and that's been sort of over the past year, 15 months or so, what we've used to mobilize people throughout the U.S. So if you're not familiar with the bill, it's no longer a live bill. We'll be working to reintroduce a version, hopefully in the coming weeks, but HR 4391 sought to ensure U.S. taxpayer funds or not be used to support grave violations against of human rights against Palestinian children detained by Israeli forces. The way that the bill works is that it required the Secretary of State to certify that no funds from the foreign military financing package that Israel receives from the U.S. are used to support certain prohibited practices in the bill. Those prohibited practices are torture, ill treatment, denying access to counsel, administrative detention or detention without charge, solitary confinement for interrogation purposes, right? These are things that universally are violations not just of human rights law, but international humanitarian law, Geneva Conventions. They violate provisions of the Rome Statute for the International Criminal Court. If you're a Palestinian child arrested, detained, and charged with throwing stones, for example, in the military courts, right, you have the right not to be tortured. Right? It doesn't matter the gravity of the offense. Whatever you're alleged to have done, you have that absolute prohibition against torture. And that's the thing that we really want to sort of hone in on. Because on one level, it makes things very clear. Right? If you support this legislation, you're standing up against the torture of children. If you don't support this legislation, you're essentially condoning these policies and practices that have been documented for decades as being widespread, systematic, and institutionalized within the Israeli military detention system. And that stark, sort of polarized issue, right, is where we want to create our campaign and move things forward. Because we know that not everybody in Congress is going to jump on the bill and support the things that we're saying from a policy perspective. But we want something that if they're going to say no to it, right, there's a cost. Or there's something that we can use to take back in district and mobilize people around that ridiculous thing that they use to justify that treatment. And that's sort of where the work for advocates, activists come in. So my lesson two would be that we need sustained and regular engagement with lawmakers and their staff, both in Washington and locally in district. That's really what facilitates the political work that's necessary. We need to create space. They need to know that you'll be talking to them. You'll be in their office. If something happens, right, you're going to be there. That's really, you know, what the campaign is meant to do. We know we don't have the political power yet to really force that change. It's growing. There's a lot of movement happening, right? But we really do need the political work to be done side by side, kind of other efforts to force that change that we need. And maybe just as a show of hands, how many people have contacted their member of Congress this week? Okay, so not many. How many people contracted a member of the Congress this month? Okay, better. How many people have a specific contact in the local district office or DC office where they know the name, they know the phone number, they know the email? Okay, not bad. How many people think we can do better? How many people think we need to do better? Right? I think that's really the core of it, right? How many people emailed this conference to their staff, you know, their representative? Right? How many people flagged this conference for staffers in DC? Right? We can all do that. And that's sort of the sustained... You take the email that Dale sends, you take the email for the congressional office, right? That's, you're their constituents. They have to listen to you. They don't have to agree with you. They have to listen to you, right? You forward that email from Dale and say, I would like somebody in this office to attend and report back, right? This is how we create that sustained engagement. That's how we develop the relationships, show that there's space, right, to discuss Palestinian rights issues, and that's how we do the political work to force the change that we need. Let's see. So sustain engagements, build relationships, right? That's all at the core of the campaign that we've created and why it's successful. Anything you can do to create vehicles, right? So with the campaign, the vehicle we created was Dear Colleague letters, congressional briefings, legislation, and now, right, the goal and task for all of you is to figure out how to create vehicles locally. If you have a film screening, right, invite the local folks from the district office to the event. It doesn't matter if they come or not, right? Let them know about it. Use that to create that space to have that engagement with the things that you're already doing. And then the last sort of lesson that really has allowed us to do what we've done is having advocates speaking from personal experience on the ground, right? I've been to the West Bank. I've seen children that have been detained. I've been to Hebron. I've seen children going to school, walking through military checkpoints, right? Use that personal experience as part of your engagement with policymakers. So if you haven't gone, go. Eyewitness Palestine has a table. You can talk to them about a June trip. And there's many different delegations that go to the region each year. So I'll stop there and look forward to questions.
All right. Thank you very much. So I guess we'll begin here. Most of the people, I think, who signed on the bill were more to the left side of the Democratic Party, of those 30 members that signed McCollum's bill. What was the engagement like with other Democrats? I'm thinking the Ted Deutsches, the Elliot Engels, who are pro-Israel but otherwise very liberal. What was the reaction and your engagement with them?
A hard no would be the way to probably put it, most diplomatic. I think, you know, obviously we know that we work on congressional advocacy related to Palestinian rights. It's not going to be well received by the majority of even Democratic progressive members. So the challenge is really working with constituents in those districts, right, where they're putting questions at town halls to the Elliot Engels, the Jerry Nadlers, folks that, you know, do support, you know, a non-rights-respecting policy related to Palestinians, and use the sort of polarized nature of, you know, you either support torture or you're against torture, right? There's sort of no in-between. And use that to force conversations, even if they're not in agreement, right? There's still utility in educating, you know, the constituents in that district around the issues that are happening on the ground, but also that their so-called progressive member of Congress is creating this pretty extreme exception for Israeli forces, at least on this issue. And that's really, I think, for what we're trying to do in the moment we're in, is the valuable piece, because it's really about, in some ways, exploiting the congressional advocacy and the direct engagement to just build a bigger movement of people demanding rights and justice for Palestinians.
I assume there was a similar hard no from Republicans that were
engaged. Maybe I'll
engaged.
Stand.
Okay, sure.
Okay. Yeah, for Republicans, yes. Yeah, there's been outreach, and this is where some of our partners, faith-based partners particularly, have been instrumental in trying to get... Thank you. And I may just sit down again, but... some of the different churches that we partner with, different mainline Protestant denominations, have been doing a lot of outreach to Republican offices, making the case for why this bill is necessary, and why this bill also, you know, is situated within existing U.S. law, as a means to facilitate conversations there, with the understanding that it's probably very unlikely that we have a Republican member of Congress sort of join as a co-sponsor.
Right. And someone wants to know if there was, while you were doing this effort on the Hill, any pushback, I guess, from AIPAC or any other pro-Israel group? Were they making their views known on this?
Yeah, right. We know the context with which we work. AIPAC, J Street, you know, everybody works with members of Congress on their particular issues. We have had, you know, and it usually, you know, there's, so if you look, you can find online probably different AIPAC talking points around the bill, around military detention. And this is sort of the, when I talk about empowering members of Congress to sort of hold their ground, this is where having it be focused on something like an absolute prohibition of torture really is the thing that allows them to do that, right? So what are you going to say to justify the torture of a child, right? In some ways, let's let AIPAC try to do that, right? Because it just reaffirms everything that we're saying about a rights-based approach to human rights for Palestinians, but also foreign policy generally. So in some ways, the pushback that we've had from AIPAC, at least with the more progressive offices, Democratic offices, really just reaffirms everything that we're saying. So in some ways, they're one of our stronger allies on the issue.
Someone would like to know if you think a campaign similar to No Way to Treat a Child could be used to fight against the collective punishment of people living in Gaza.
Yeah. I mean, I think the challenge is we have to think creatively and figure out how we can do it, right? I think my short answer is yes. Right, you find the way. I think the thing that we've tried to do is show that we don't have to always be reactionary. We don't always have to be on the defensive. Right, we can be proactive. We can create our own vehicles and shift the burden from ourselves to policymakers, to lawmakers, and say, you know, where do you stand on this? Right, and that's the political work we need to do. And for sure, there's a way to do it around Gaza. You know, we also work on documenting violations against children in Gaza, and you know, the unlawful killing, the intentional use of lethal force as part of the Gaza March of Return protests. Right, this is all something that we're trying to figure out what we can do around congressional advocacy. So, very timely question, and I think it can be done. Right, we just have to think creatively how to do it.
One final question: someone wants to know if you've seen any difference in approach on the ground with the Israeli military and children ever since this campaign has started.
No. I think that's the constant. Ill treatment is widespread, systematic, and institutionalized. Rather than address the violations that are ongoing, the physical violence that children face, the work is put into criticizing the messenger. So whether it's DCI Palestine or Israeli human rights organizations, right, civil society space within Israel, within the occupied Palestinian territory, is shrinking dramatically. Human rights organizations are under attack in many ways, and extreme amounts of energy and effort are put into chilling speech, silencing folks, rather than just, you know, implementing rights-respecting policies. And that it's obvious, I think, why policies aren't reformed. The goal isn't that, the military courts, for example, are holding children accountable for specific wrongdoing, right? The goal of the military courts and the military law is to work to control the Palestinian population, right? If you arrest 700 to, even 1,000 15-year-old adolescent boys from their homes in the middle of the night, ill-treat 3 out of 4 of them, their fathers can't save them, their mothers can't save them, right? Their community can't save them. You're stripping down everything that those children have as protections in their community. And that fragmentation of families, fragmentations of communities, that's the goal, right? Military courts targeting children for arrest, it's really about controlling the Palestinian population. It's not about specific wrongdoing.
You have been listening to Brad Parker of Defense for Children International speaking about his work defending children in Palestine who face large incarceration rates under Israeli occupation. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.